Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Bob Weeks, member of the club's program committee and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association. Mr. Greco was born in Italy, raised near Chicago, and pursued his legal career in Boston, Massachusetts. A trial lawyer with more than 30 years of litigation experience, he has served as an arbitrator and mediator in complex business and other disputes on both the state and national levels. Mr. Greco has been president of both the Massachusetts Bar Association and the New England Bar Association. He is a strong advocate for legal services for the poor and for protecting the legal rights of children. A member of the ABA House of Delegates since 1985, Mr. Greco has been chair of the prestigious Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary and many other ABA posts. After September 11, 2001, he served on the ABA Task Force on Terrorism and the Law, and also served on the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. Mr. Greco's topic is Living Within the Law, Next Steps in the War on Terror. Please welcome an inspiring leader, a passionate advocate, and my friend, Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association. Mr. Greco.
Thank you very much, Bob, for that kind introduction. When you were mentioning all the bars that I've been president of, I hope people in the audience don't get the wrong idea that I hang out at bars. Those are organizations of lawyers. And I thought you were going to do, Bob, what hasn't happened to me, but someday it may, introduce me as someone who deserves no introduction. But I want to thank the Commonwealth Club of California for inviting me to speak this evening to talk about an issue that now pervades the lives of every American in our country. And the issue is, what is the proper balance between national security and individual freedoms in our country? Put differently, will our government preserve our cherished freedoms in the fight against terrorism? September 11, 2001 made it abundantly clear to all of us that we have real enemies who are bent on our destruction, who pose new threats to which our government must respond. The most fundamental responsibility entrusted to the executive branch of our government under our Constitution is to safeguard the nation. But the people have a right to expect that the executive branch, no less than Congress and the courts, will also safeguard our freedoms. Our military, our intelligence community, and other public and private institutions must continually adapt to the new realities of an asymmetrical warfare at home and abroad. It is a daunting and unforgiving task, one that demands great vigilance, flexibility, and expertise. The men and women who heroically defend our nation's security deserve our utmost respect and gratitude and our strongest support. The American Bar Association, in a series of policy recommendations adopted in the months and years after 9/11, has expressed full support for the administration's efforts to pursue terrorists and deter future attacks, but in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution of the United States. During the past 5 years, the American Bar Association has called repeatedly on our government to stay within the parameters of our enacted laws and Constitution in protecting our national security. Threats of terrorist attacks have led the administration to restrict the freedoms and sense of openness that have defined our democracy. And until now, the majority of Americans and members of Congress and the media, with a mixture of patriotism, trust, and fear, have given the administration wide leeway. But the American people increasingly are coming to the view that the administration is not adequately balancing security and freedom. Our history should serve as a guide. While foreign terrorism in America is new, grave threats to our national security are not. In the past, faced with such threats, we have managed to prevail against enemies while preserving our freedoms and our adherence to the rule of law. At times, however, our government abandoned the ideals and principles on which our republic was founded, and in the process, we brought shame on ourselves. Some of the sorriest chapters of American history were written when our constitutional freedoms were ignored in times of peril. Consider the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, the communist scares of the 1920s, 1950s. In time, we came to our senses. We came to realize that we had made serious mistakes in ignoring the protections that afford all of us under the Constitution. Perhaps the greatest non-biblical document ever written. In plain terms, I say to you, we must demand that our nation strike the proper balance between security and liberty so that we do not add to the sorriest chapters in our nation's history. Many of the administration's responses to 9/11 have led to widespread concern that civil liberties are being compromised in the name of protecting national security. There is now growing evidence that more and more Americans are alarmed about what is happening to the principles and values that have defined America throughout our history. They are troubled and even ashamed at reports that detainees and prisoners have been abused and tortured, and are worried that their privacy has been invaded by secret government surveillance programs. More Americans are now rejecting fear-mongering and scare tactics as the means of persuasion and basis of decision-making of our government. Since 9/11, Americans repeatedly have been given a choice that the American Bar Association and I personally reject as a false choice, a choice that Americans must sacrifice freedom in order to gain security. We must firmly insist that our government protect both freedom and security, as it has throughout our nation's history. No one questions the administration's sincere desire to protect Americans from harm, but history has taught us that governments are made of fallible humans. As the great jurist Louis Brandeis warned, and I quote, "Experience should teach us to be most on our guard to protect liberty when the government's purposes are beneficent." He said further, "The greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning, but without understanding." As the national voice of the legal profession, the 400,000-member American Bar Association, the largest voluntary professional association in the world, takes very seriously our responsibility to speak out on fundamental issues affecting the rights and liberties of all Americans. I, like many of you here, have a deep faith in the rule of law. It is my belief that the law can protect our rights at all times, even during perilous times, that we should be suspicious of those who say otherwise. I believe that the law is resilient enough to resolve conflicting needs. And when those individual laws may fail, in our democracy, we work together to change them. This, in fact, is more than just faith. It is our nation's history. And it is a roadmap to how we as a nation can maintain the rule of law in America as we fight terrorists. That roadmap was given to us by the founders of our country, the drafters of the Constitution, and it has been followed honorably and religiously by presidents, members of Congress, and our courts for more than two centuries, in peace and in war. Our government, the greatest and longest-lasting democracy in history, was formed as a response to runaway and unchecked power. The first Americans were forced to pay taxes without representation and to endure searches of their homes without warrants. My law firm's office in Boston is a stone's throw away from the site of the Boston Tea Party, the response of Americans to the king's taxation without representation, which became a catalyst for the American Revolution. Outrage and disgust of Americans with warrantless searches and invasions of privacy by the king was the match that ignited the American Revolution. Our founders were acutely suspicious of power that could not be checked. James Madison, one of the leading drafters of the Constitution, bluntly warned his colleagues and us in these words, quote, "All power in human hands is likely to be abused. The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary in the same hands may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny." Yet Madison and others also recognized that a weak government posed dangers as well. Their solution was nothing less than genius. They created a strong national government, but separated its powers among three branches: Congress, the executive branch, and the independent judiciary. Each branch was given discrete powers, and each was given ways to check and balance the powers of the other two. Today, the brilliant design of our founders faces an unprecedented threat. For those of you who remember the character Pogo, who said, "We have met the enemy, and it is us," you may now see deeper meaning in those words. Take the issue of electronic surveillance, for example. Today's version of the warrantless searches that led our founders to start a revolution. The question today is not whether the government can lawfully eavesdrop on Americans to protect our security. It can. The real issue is whether the executive branch can, on its own, authorize and conduct long-term secret electronic surveillance without the checks and balances from the judiciary or Congress that is required by our Constitution. It cannot. Moreover, the successful prosecution of the war on terror, which is a war of ideas and values and not just of weapons, demands that we steadfastly adhere to the rule of law. Secret prisons, the torture and extraordinary rendition of prisoners and secret invasions of privacy of American citizens simply do not reflect our nation's values. These examples, among others we could add, are an affront to this nation's core values and to the moral fiber of all Americans. Where does the American Bar Association stand? Since 9/11, the ABA House of Delegates has adopted 9 major policy recommendations to balance the necessity for anti-terrorism measures with the need to protect civil liberties. In many of these policies, the ABA has firmly rejected the administration's claim that it can take virtually any action to fight terrorism without any oversight or limits by Congress or the courts. Let us take one example, the treatment of the detainees held at Guantanamo Bay and other prisons who have been accused by an unidentified someone but never charged or tried of aiding terrorist causes. The administration has argued that our cherished federal court system, the envy of every nation in the free world, which has seen us through every crisis since the founding of our country, has no jurisdiction over these cases, that the detainees have no right to civilian counsel, and even that they can be held secretly and indefinitely as if they are not human beings. The ABA's policy position regarding detainees is firmly grounded in the Constitution, that everyone in America is guaranteed fundamental fairness and due process, and that everyone in America is guaranteed the right to be represented by counsel, to be charged specifically or released from incarceration, and to have any charges reviewed by a civilian court. The ABA has filed friend of the court or amicus briefs in cases such as Hamdi versus Rumsfeld in the U.S. Supreme Court and Padilla versus Rumsfeld in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. In these cases, the ABA has argued that U.S. citizens and residents detained within the United States as enemy combatants should have access to a lawyer and meaningful judicial review of their status. We have argued that our courts cannot simply be brushed aside by the administration or Congress, especially on matters that deprive detainees of their rights. Why? Because in time, such deprivation may be visited on others in America. The ABA was pleased in June 2004 when the Supreme Court in the Hamdi decision affirmed the ABA's policy position. The issues presented in the Hamdi and Padilla cases speak directly to the crucial role that our courts have and that they must continue to have in protecting the fundamental rights guaranteed by our Constitution. These cases and many other situations that have arisen during the past 5 years also have serious implications for the lawyer's role in providing effective counsel to individual clients and assistance to the court in making decisions based on all of the relevant facts in the law. The administration's insistence on the use of military tribunals to try suspected terrorists and enemy combatants also raises a host of legal issues. The ABA adopted a policy on military tribunals in February 2002, and the task force that Mr. Weeks mentioned in his introduction to me was the task force that crafted that policy. And that policy urged that such tribunals be used, if at all, only in limited circumstances, and that defendants facing military tribunals should be afforded basic due process rights, including legal representation by civilian defense counsel. If the world is to be persuaded by the administration that these tribunals are unbiased, they must conform to the rules of fairness and due process set forth in the long existing and respected Uniform Code of Military Justice. In February 2002, the ABA also adopted policy opposing incommunicado detention by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, in which immigrants are held without access to family members, friends, or a lawyer. The United States should not be in the business of subjecting U.S. citizens or foreign nationals to secret, criminal, or administrative proceedings. Only in the rarest of circumstances, when the government can demonstrate a distinct threat to national security, should someone be detained or tried in secret. And even then, there must be afforded the right of an appeal to safeguard the very American principle that justice has been done. The very credibility of our justice system and laws is built on the notion that we conduct our business in America in the open, where advocates, family members, journalists, and the public can observe all proceedings and vouch for their fairness, or speak publicly about their shortcomings when necessary to keep the government honest. This, after all, is what has distinguished America from every communist, fascist, and other tyrannical regime throughout history that eventually was or will be brought down. At the least, it was a lack of openness and a failure in oversight and training that led to the reprehensible abuse of detainees and prisoners in U.S. custody that dominated newspaper headlines in our conscience 2 years ago, and that made all of us hang our heads in shame. Based on the fundamental principle that the United States must be the first to adhere to the rule of law in order to maintain the moral high ground and the world's respect, the ABA several times has called for an independent, bipartisan commission to examine the U.S. government's treatment of foreign detainees and prisoners, to determine what happened, why it happened, and who was responsible, to sanction those responsible, and to prevent it from ever happening again. The ABA has condemned the use of torture and cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment of prisoners, and called on our government to ensure that its interrogation policies and treatment of detainees comply fully with the law. My predecessor as ABA president and my good friend Robert J. Gray spoke to you about this subject nearly 2 years ago. The U.S. is still grappling with the repercussions and ramifications of the unacceptable treatment of detainees at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. The administration has not responded to letters sent by Robert Gray and me, several of them, on this and related subjects, has not responded to us. The ABA supported the amendment offered in Congress by Senator John McCain that banned the torture of individuals in U.S. custody, and that amendment became law after the administration's failed attempt to derail it. Such principled actions by our Congress and our courts are an absolute necessity if we are to be viewed as credible and respected champions of the rule of law and democratic values around the world. There was a time when no one in the world doubted that about the United States. Sadly, today, there is doubt. The ABA believes that all of us, especially lawyers, must be demonstrably committed to the principle that America must protect the rule of law at home if we hope to advance and protect it abroad. We must be assured that there are no pockets anywhere, including the United States, where the rule of law does not apply, where the fundamental rights of men and women and children are not protected. Even a suspicion that such pockets exist undermines the rule of law. The U.S. government is doing tremendous work around the world to support the development of the rule of law and peaceful civil societies. The ABA is also doing its part to advance the rule of law in emerging democracies around the world. We have rule of law programs in some 40 of those countries, and I have visited some 20 of those countries, and I've seen firsthand the yearning of people abroad to have what we have in the United States, and that we are squandering or letting some of our leaders do that. But in order to maintain our credibility abroad, the U.S. must ensure that we practice at home what we preach abroad. On a very related subject, our government must also adhere to the rule of law in its intelligence gathering activities. The disclosure last December of the administration's secret electronic surveillance program, in which telephone calls and emails were and apparently still are being monitored, shocked Americans and constitutional scholars. This program, the details of which are still shrouded from view, has subjected an unknown number of persons in our country to secret electronic surveillance without authorization by courts or Congress. In response, I appointed the ABA Task Force on Domestic Surveillance in the Fight Against Terrorism last January. The task force and its advisors comprised an extraordinarily distinguished, balanced, bipartisan group, including the former director of the FBI, a former general counsel of the CIA, and the National Security Agency, which is doing the surveillance, and respected experts in constitutional law and national security law. The task force produced a unanimous report and unanimous recommendations that were adopted by an overwhelming majority vote in the ABA House of Delegates, which numbers 550 lawyers and judges from all over the country. There were at most four or five no votes audible after the vote. If you're interested in reading the full report of that task force, it's available on the ABA website, the address of which is www.abanet.org. This ABA task force unanimously agreed on recommendations designed to ensure that the rule of law does not become a casualty in the fight against terrorism. The urgency of the task force's findings was magnified last month when USA Today reported on another massive intelligence program of the administration that allegedly has gathered data on purely domestic phone calls made by millions of Americans. What did the ABA Task Force on Surveillance recommend? First, that any electronic surveillance inside the U.S. must comply with the provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. That means that all electronic eavesdropping must be overseen by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a court that was designed specifically to balance national security investigations with constitutional requirements to safeguard civil liberties. If the president believes that the FISA law is inadequate to protect national security, he must consult with and seek appropriate amendments or new legislation from Congress. Congress has already amended FISA four times since 9/11. Why didn't the president seek another amendment from Congress? Second, the ABA position is that Congress must reclaim its oversight role and conduct thorough investigations of all surveillance and data gathering programs conducted in the United States. There are many in our country who believe that Congress is abdicating its role under our separation of powers doctrine to serve as a check and balance on the administration. After many months of refusal, administration officials finally briefed the full Senate and House Intelligence Committees last month on the NSA's electronic surveillance program. This briefing is a positive step, but it falls far short of what needs to be done. The American people have a right to know whether there is any legal authority that supports the president's troubling surveillance and data gathering programs. Who has been spied on, and what use has been made of the data gathered? It is impossible for Congress to reform our laws without this information, and the ABA is urging Congress not to do so until it has received from the administration this information that Congress is entitled to and that the American people are entitled to. The findings of the ABA task force are consistent with court rulings and acts of Congress over the years, specifically in the area of electronic surveillance. As the Supreme Court said in a 1971 wiretapping case, quote, "The very heart of the Fourth Amendment, which bars unreasonable searches and seizures, involves review by an independent court." The Supreme Court added in that case, quote, "The Fourth Amendment does not contemplate the executive officers of government as neutral and detached magistrates. The Fourth Amendment contemplates a prior judicial judgment." Congress itself passed the FISA law in 1978 after several serious scandals of the 1970s showed that our government leaders could and did abuse personal privacy with improper domestic surveillance. FISA balances security needs and privacy rights by permitting the government secretly to obtain search warrants, but with conditions. In emergencies, investigators can begin wiretapping immediately as long as they seek a warrant within a specified time. This common sense balancing of security and civil liberties is also consistent with public sentiment. I am heartened by the fact that the new ABA policy on domestic surveillance reflects the views of the majority of the American people. In a national survey conducted for the ABA by Harris Interactive this past February, 77% of Americans indicated that the president, on his own, should not suspend constitutional freedoms. 25% within that total think that the president must obtain approval from Congress or the courts before constitutional freedoms are suspended. Only 18% believe that the president alone can suspend those freedoms whenever he thinks it necessary to protect national security. The ABA's policy on secret surveillance reflects, as was the case in 1776, that Americans worry about and view with disdain warrantless searches, whether conducted by a king or the executive. The awesome power of government to penetrate citizens' most private communications must not be held solely in the hands of the executive branch. There must be checks and balances and oversight by Congress and the courts. All Americans want to trust that their government is protecting both their physical security and their freedoms. But the word of one branch, the trust us pledge, is not good enough. Our system guarantees accountability and adherence to the law by requiring more than one branch of government to certify the legality of governmental actions. The crucial roles that Congress and the courts have in holding the executive branch accountable cannot be ignored by the administration and must be protected by the American people. And while the people may not have an absolute right to know all the details of our government's anti-terrorism efforts, the people do have a right and the responsibility to ensure that our government is not violating the law or the Constitution. Congress should give the administration the laws it needs aggressively to fight terrorism and protect the American people. But the administration cannot be allowed to ignore the will of Congress or the people's elected representatives by disregarding laws enacted by Congress. Because in America, no one is above the law, not even the president. Once our liberties are lost, it is difficult, if not impossible, to regain them. President Bush and others have said that the terrorists hate us, at least in part, because of our freedoms. They resent our open society, built on tolerance for and protection of diverse viewpoints. If we forsake our freedoms and the foundations of our government in the name of deterring terrorists, we may win some battles, but we will most assuredly lose the most important war being waged, the war of ideas. Since 9/11, we have witnessed many disturbing developments in the administration's campaign against terrorism. We've learned about secret prisons, rendition of detainees to nations that practice torture, abusive treatment by U.S. personnel, unprecedented imprisonment without charges, the unauthorized intelligence gathering on American citizens. In recent news, those of you who've been following this story have brought to light the increasingly frequent use of signing statements that the president appends to duly enacted laws by Congress that he signs. It was disclosed by the Boston Globe on April 30, and there was another story this past weekend that the president has indicated he doesn't feel bound by 750 or more laws enacted by Congress during the past 5 years. This past weekend, in New Orleans, the American Bar Association Board of Governors met, and they unanimously approved my request to appoint the ABA Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements and the Separation of Powers Doctrine. This group, distinguished group, 10 bipartisan, outstanding constitutional and presidential scholars, composed of men and women who served in the Reagan administration, the Nixon administration, the Bush 1 administration, and the Clinton administration. They are Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives. I have asked this group to determine whether the president's practice of not vetoing, not giving Congress a chance to override his veto, but indicating that he doesn't intend to follow these laws, whether that is consistent with the separation of powers doctrine, and to make other recommendations as may be appropriate. A prominent example of a bill that the president has attached such a statement to is the very bill I referred to earlier, the torture amendment that Congress debated for months, banning the use of torture by U.S. military and government personnel. The president has indicated that as commander-in-chief, he does not feel bound to follow that law. The task force will report to the ABA House of Delegates by August, and we will debate whether we adopt another policy addressing actions of the administration. But let me wind down and share with you a couple of final thoughts. I think you've gotten my message that we must insist that fundamental principles such as the separation of powers and checks and balances, which have allowed our republic to survive for more than two centuries, must continue to guide all of the actions of our government. The American people have a right to it, and sooner or later, they will demand it. When any one branch of government attempts to place itself above or usurp the constitutionally mandated roles of the other branches, our democracy is threatened. We have now reached a point where we must ask ourselves whether these practices of our government are isolated and unconnected, or whether they form a pattern that threatens the very foundations of the rule of law in the United States. Defenders of the administration maintain that these practices are legal. In several instances, however, these defenses have been offered only after the press has revealed the existence of programs and practices that were kept secret from Congress and the American people for years. Under our system of government, the executive branch must not be allowed to determine the legality of its actions. That is the role of Congress and the courts. That is the very essence of separation of powers and checks and balances. This administration seems not to understand or endorse the basic principle of checks and balances. It is time for the American people to make clear to the administration and to our Congress that our Constitution and laws cannot be ignored or violated. The message to our elected officials is straightforward. Do not violate the law. Do not trample on our freedoms. Delivery of this message should not depend on political affiliation or partisan politics. This is not about partisan politics. It is not about conservatives and liberals. It is not about Republicans and Democrats. It is about preserving our country. It is about maintaining the freedoms that countless Americans throughout our history have sacrificed their lives to protect. It is about reclaiming America's proud identity throughout the world as the land of the free, the land of the just. If the people permit any administration, now or ever, to take away our freedoms in the name of national security, we would be giving the enemy a victory that he could never achieve on his own. You and I must use every power of our reasoning, every ounce of our energy, and every fiber of our beings to prevent that from happening. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
Our thanks to Michael Greco, President of the American Bar Association, for his comments this evening. I'm Jesse Choper, Earl Warren Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley's Bold Hall, moderating this evening's discussion period. Mr. Greco, we have a large number of questions, but before beginning, one comment for our radio audience, and that is that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Michael Greco, President of the American Bar Association, who has discussed the constitutionality of various actions by the Bush administration in respect to the war on terrorism. The first question, to what extent does our citizenry's seeming apathy indicate the views of the American people? And apart from writing members of Congress, do you have any specific suggestions as to what concerned citizens can do to challenge what they disagree with?
Let me take the second part first. First, Americans have a vote, and their election's coming up. And that is the traditional way that Americans have a way of expressing themselves about what their elected officials are doing. And so think about that one. With respect to the apathy part, in my remarks, I referred to Americans increasingly rejecting fear-mongering and scare tactics as the basis for decision-making by our government. At heart, the American people are good people. They trust their government. And the government is asking the people to trust them, that what they're doing is necessary. I think apathy is not the right word. I think there's a mixture of fear and trust and patriotism that is causing the American people to continue to give leeway to the government. But the winds are changing. I think more Americans are seeing that it isn't enough to be frightened into the state of mind that has existed so far.
What of those Americans who say that these are different times with enemies unlike any other, that ignore all rules of warfare and justice, and that these require new constraints on citizens' rights?
There's no doubt that we are in the midst of a new era. The question is, does this new era present a situation where we can voluntarily agree as Americans to have our government take away the very freedoms that the terrorists are trying to destroy with violence? Put differently, if we give up our own freedoms, permit them to be given up, aren't we co-conspirators with the enemy in doing destruction to our democracy?
As to the detainees at Guantanamo, almost all of whom were found in Afghanistan, aren't they enemy combatants who, under the laws of war, have been held for the duration of the war without any legal assistance in all prior wars?
Not true. The program at Guantanamo, in which people have now been held for almost 5 years, being denied due process, being charged with a crime, being afforded counsel, being afforded review by a judge of their incarceration, the U.S. Supreme Court in June of 2004 found that treatment unacceptable and essentially ordered the government to either release those people or charge them, and if charged, give them fair trials. And what happened? Congress, months ago, enacted the Graham-Levin Amendment, which denies the people in Guantanamo the very American right of the writ of habeas corpus. Anyone who is incarcerated in the United States can petition a court to have his or her incarceration reviewed. That right has been taken away from the people at Guantanamo. The ABA forcefully objected, and I wrote letters to the entire Senate. We can't be Pollyannish. We are confronted by terrorism. The issue is, can we fight terror and preserve our freedoms? If the answer to that question is no, then why are we fighting?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker this evening is Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association, who is discussing the constitutionality of various actions taken by the government during the war on terrorism. Mr. Greco, would you comment on your own opinion of legal systems in other countries and what you believe to be the best model for safeguarding individual rights here? And are England and Israel more protective of individual rights than we are in wars of this sort?
I don't know enough about Israel, but I know enough to comment that England, regrettably, has followed the lead of the United States. There are nations of the world, and you know the irony, what the irony is. The 20 or so nations that I have visited in the last year and a half, former Soviet republics who were in the grips of tyranny for all that time. They want to be like the United States, with an independent judiciary, with separation of powers, so that they get away from an oppressive executive branch, and get away from a judiciary that's controlled by either the executive or parliament. The answer to the question is, the best system in the world is ours. But it won't be if we don't protect it. We will become like these countries that are aspiring to be what we are. And that would be the ultimate tragedy. I can't say it strongly enough. The United States, despite what's happening right now, continues to serve as the beacon of hope for the nations of the world that want to create democracies. We will fail them as much as we will fail ourselves if we permit our democracy to be undermined. And that's why I said to you, we cannot permit that to happen.
The recent trial of the so-called 20th hijacker, Musahi, was heard in the regular federal courts because he was charged with a federal crime. What applicability, if any, does that have on the potential trial of all those 400-plus people who now held on Guantanamo?
One would hope that the administration, looking at this trial in our federal courts, would find comfort in knowing that our courts can be trusted, as they have been for two centuries, to deal with the kind of issues that we're dealing with, and that we shouldn't turn our back on the courts. So I'm hoping that more and more of the people at Guantanamo will either be released or charged and tried in our federal courts.
Please comment on the Defense Department's decision this week to forego the Geneva Convention's ban on, quote, humiliating and degrading treatment, unquote, of detainees. Do you believe that this was correct? Do you believe it will have any impact on any arrests made in the United States, in contrast to those who are being held in Guantanamo, all of whom were arrested abroad? Could it impact the rights of citizens, rather of United States citizens, rather than aliens, all of whom are not, in Guantanamo, being non-citizens?
If I asked that question in court, my opposing counsel would object that it's a multi-part question. There are at least four or five or six parts, but let me see if I can try to combine all of them into this notion. The Geneva Conventions are not something that are floating out there. We are bound by the Geneva Conventions. Those are treaties, and treaties that have been enacted and approved in the United States have the force of law just as our Constitution does. And so for the Defense Department to say that we're not going to be bound by those treaties is like the President saying 750 times that he doesn't feel bound by acts of Congress. It's the same issue. We have to insist that our government adhere to the Geneva Conventions. Why? Not just because it is law for us, but because when our men and women are subjected abroad to arrest, they have the right to say, if you don't honor the Geneva Conventions for people you arrest, why should we honor them for your young men and women? That's the short-sightedness of what the Defense Department has done, and the American Bar Association is foursquare on record as urging our government to abide by the Geneva Conventions.
The administration's position has been that this provision of the Geneva Convention does not apply to unlawful enemy combatants. Do you have any comment about that? That is to say that they were not taken in a connection with the ordinary definition which entitles someone to become a prisoner of war.
Do you remember the when you go into a carnival when we were kids, there'd be the three walnut shells, the half shells, and you were asked to guess where the pea was? That's what this reminds me of. There are times when we are told that this is not a war. War has not been declared, and therefore these people at Guantanamo do not have the rights of prisoners of war. There are other times when we're told, yes, war was declared, and we're fighting a war throughout the world. Well, which is it? Let's get our story straight. But the real answer is that whether war has been declared or not, we have fundamental values in this country. We don't torture people. We don't send people to be tortured in other countries where our government can escape those restrictions. Every human being is entitled, whether they are the most heinous criminal, and we have them in our country. We have murderers and rapists, known murderers and rapists, and they have the right to a fair trial. Don't people who are incarcerated for whatever reasons that we don't know, we've never been told why these people are in Guantanamo, other than they are suspected of having terrorist connections. America requires more. And no matter what somebody says in the government, the ABA says the people at Guantanamo deserve a hearing before a judge with counsel and allowed to see their families. That's just basic human treatment. And I don't care who says otherwise.
If the administration said that these people at best are prisoners of war, having been captured on the battlefield, and that nothing in the history of the world has ever given prisoners of war an opportunity to have any hearings whatever, unless they're prosecuted, unless they're charged with crimes, war crimes, but that they are simply held in custody until the end of the war, what would your response be?
Well, first of all, if the administration were to so indicate that these people are prisoners of war.
Yes, they don't know. They say they're not entitled. They're worth. They get less than prisoners of war, is the administration's position. They are unlawful, not lawful enemy combatants.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on this point. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that the people at Guantanamo, whether U.S. citizens or not, have a right to be charged or released. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not prisoners of war.
Let me ask this question. Given the court's deference to the executive on matters of national security and war, where is the check on the power to be found when Congress, as you've already indicated, has removed the right of federal court jurisdiction on Guantanamo? Where is the check on power that you're so eloquently requesting? Where is it going to be found in this country?
Well, first, I hope that Congress comes around. And there are hopeful signs that that might happen, even before the midterm elections happen. Because the consensus is that if only one of the houses in Congress were of a different party, there would be a different situation with hearings and subpoenas and all of that. So that change alone at the ballot box. But the courts have been deferential. They always are in time of war. And Congress has been deferential, and the American people have been deferential. But 5 years into it now, I think the people have a right, and the courts have a right, and Congress has a right to start asking questions. And that is what's happening now.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association, who is discussing the constitutionality of various administrative actions in connection with the war against terrorism. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. Here it is. My fear is that after the Bush administration, it will be very difficult to get any of these matters off the books or to stop them. Dash, torture, sequestered evidence, state secrets, citizen surveillance, and Patriot Act searches. Comment?
I disagree with that. And anyone who agrees with that is giving up the right that you and I have as Americans to make sure that what's in that question will never happen. We are in a democracy. We are in a republic. We are free people. And if the next administration tries to continue these policies, the American people can deal with it. But first, we have to deal with what we have now. And I think if you take nothing else away from my remarks tonight, please take this away. We must insist that the fight on terror protect not only our safety, but our freedoms. And if we see signs that that isn't going to change, then the American people, from 1775 to now, have to act, have to express their views to their elected officials, Congress, administration, the courts, and to each other. Because I think it's time that we have these dialogues in America. There is too much at stake. Thank you very much for giving me the chance to share some thoughts with you.
Our thanks to Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association, for his comments today, and we also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.